I'm very excited to have Walter Crockett live in the music room taping the story of his life. Walter, tell us everything from the beginning to now.
I was born and I'm still alive.
Yeah.
Great to be here with you, Gail. Been looking forward to this for a long time. Nice to be had.
Me too. So how did it all begin?
Oh. You wanted to hear about my life or about the musical
well,
part of
probably
it?
The, you know, a little bit about both, whatever you want to tell us.
Okay.
It all kind of intertwines.
Okay, well, I was born in Kansas, Lawrence, Kansas, in 1946, when my dad was just back from World War II, and he was able to take advantage of the GI Bill, which a lot of the black soldiers weren't able to, but it made a gigantic difference in our life, you know. And he was working and going to graduate school and at KU, and then he got into psychology, so we went to Michigan to get a PhD, University of Michigan. Moved up there when I was 3, which is really when my first memories are, and that was great. We lived in a very tar paper shack, kind of row houses, but as a kid it was wonderful. You could play out in the fields, and we loved it. And my dad used to sing a lot, and he sang in college. He was in a quartet, and his specialty was Mood Indigo, singing the lead on that one. But he'd sing in the car, and when you live in the Midwest, you drive long times, and we'd drive down to Kansas sometimes. We'd drive to Mississippi to see my mother's family. And you always sing on the way. So that was part of our life, you know. But that was before rock and roll. And the things I was into were like Gene Autry, Hopalong Cassidy, until I saw him one day bald. You know, he took his hat off. And I was so depressed. And since then, I've worn a hat forever because I don't want to... Even the hair falls out underneath it. I don't want my public to be disappointed, you
Nobody
know?
Would be disappointed.
but it was that kind of music. I was singing with my sister, like, All Through the Night, Sleep My Child in Peace. I was very shy. I had a bad lisp up until the 4th grade when I finally went to speaking lesson, but I couldn't say S or SH or Z. But I wasn't really aware of it very much, and nobody picked on me. We moved back to Kansas when I was about 6, 7 and went to grade school there and lived there. And then, you know, a couple years later, it was 1955, 56, I got a transistor radio, and that's what did it. Everybody was getting transistor radios, and I think that was a... fundamental to the success of rock and roll, because you didn't have to listen on your parents' radio to something they didn't want to hear. I could listen in on WHB, I think it was, in the Kansas City Top 40 station, and hear Elvis Presley, among other things, his earliest songs, you know, Don't Be Cruel, Heartbreak Hotel, and I loved that, just loved it. And my grandmother, who was a cultured old Southern lady, they had moved from Memphis to Tupelo, Mississippi. And because Elvis was born in Tupelo, I was raised in Tupelo, and they were down there living, she would send me Elvis magazines, you know, fan magazines, pictures of Elvis, which kind of scandalized my mother because she wasn't, she thought my grandmother was getting senile or something. But she wasn't. She was just, you know, she thought Elvis was a good boy to his mother, you know, in Tupelo. But that got into me, you know, and I would, you know, I didn't have a guitar, but I would pick up a tennis racket and slick my hair back, and then I'd waggle my leg and play, and, you know, show my sister, and she would put me down, you know, my older sister, Judy, who was a great girl, also into music, and still singing these days about the Bach kind of choirs and stuff. But then we moved to Worcester. It was not a lot of fun at first, you know. It was tough, you know. You in Kansas, you're in a little town, Manhattan, Kansas, where Kansas State College was. You could ride out to the edge of town on your bicycle, you know. You could do all these things. Worcester was just very different. It was all hilly, for one thing. Mm. You know, you'd have to, every time you went anywhere, you'd have to go up some kind of hill and go back down it. And
this is funny to hear, because I've been in Worcester all my life.
That's right.
Never thought about the hills that much.
And the kids were, I mean, this doesn't sound like music, but it's part of what shaped me. I get to 1957, February, going to Tatnik School. We'd walk to school, uphill both ways, of course, and it was actually uphill both ways. The first thing they ask is, are you Catholic, Protestant, or Jewish? And I didn't know what a Protestant was, because everybody in Kansas is a Protestant, so they didn't have a name for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so I was confused, but I soon found out that the Catholics were tougher than the Jews, and the Jews were a little more predominant on my side of the Pleasant Street on Ratwood Road, and that's who I became friend with, and I didn't go to, you know. So it was a while before I had Catholic friends. I had a lot of Jewish friends, but then as you got to junior high and you want to date the girls, back in the 60s, their father weren't interested in having a non-Jewish kid date the girls, and so I became like an outcast, you know, or to me, you know, as an outlaw from the beginning, and it was kind of funny. Rock and roll was breaking out, and Buddy Holly, Buddy Knox, a Texas singer, were having hits. Johnny Mathis had hits. I even liked that stuff. There's a little record store in Tatnik where you could buy 45s. They had record hops in sixth grade. I took lessons from Mrs. Magwood, who was the dancing teacher back then, and that was right when Danny and the Juniors came out, and you could go and you can rock it, you can roll it, you can hop and even stroll it at the hop, hop, hop. That was rock and roll, you know, and what say that would be 57 maybe. And I thought you were supposed to, when you danced, you were supposed to, like, circumnavigate the whole room, besides going back and forth, you know, with your girl and twirling her and everything. So I did that all the time. It was a while before somebody told me that was not cool, but I was totally into that. I was completely into the music. And then Buddy Holly came along in the, I think it was 57. Might have been as early as 56. And they were playing that on WORC, which I would listen to. ORC was just, it was a lot of kids listening to it, and a lot of housewives, young housewives. They had housewives in those days, you know. Mm-hmm. 20-ish and everything, you know, and us 10, 11, 12-year-olds. And you'd call in every day and request songs, and they'd have the top three at 5 or 6 o'clock at night. They'd play the top three on the open house party. Request. So there was an incentive to make, to request things. And it was very democratic. And other stations around the country followed their lead. Like the ORC would break a record, you know, and it was partly because of the democratic process among their listeners, you know, sending it to number one. Other people would pick it up. So that was it was a great time, and they played all kinds of music. There, you know, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, early doo-wop, In the Still of the Night, you know, Phil Phillips, The Sea of Love. And also on into Dion and the Belmonts, you know, the white doo-wop people. And my favorite was probably the dum 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 be doo be dum 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 be doo be dum. The Del Vikings, who were the first famous integrated band in rock and roll. You know, and there haven't been that many integrated bands since then, actually, but they were the first since back 1957. They had just got on the Army, which was integrated, and they started this band, and it's just glorious harmony of vocals. You had the bass, you know, and you had the wah, 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 you know, and then you had the lead singer singing, other people singing, and I always loved harmony, so I was really into that. Then I was into Buddy Holly, which had some harmony, but it was more the, it's a little raunchier, and he also did the thing with the that thing, which they couldn't do when they did the movie about him. The guy couldn't do it. That was a real, an emotional thing he did with his throat, his glottal stop. I loved that. The song "Rave On," I remember when I was about 13, I was playing "All My Love, All of not kissing. You don't know what you've been missing. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. No. And my mother said, that's obscene.
Really?
Because she was from the South, and she knew that he was talking about sex. But teenagers, you know, you didn't necessarily at that time weren't thinking so much. You were thinking more about love. But it was the pizzazz he put into it she did not like. You know, they had grown up, my mom and dad grew up in the big band era, sort of. Mm. They were into the Weavers. They did buy a Weavers album. They weren't into other stuff like that. So I got that whole range of stuff. I loved to do it. And I would see this kid in the sixth grade who had, when I was in the fifth, with long hair combed back like the Everly Brothers or some of those rockers. And I said, I got to have hair like that. But it never worked. And I finally figured out that I was better if I tried to look like Buddy Holly, because he was the homely rock and roll star. You know? And he was taking guitar lessons. He'd carry his guitar around. So a year later or so, I started taking guitar lessons down at Perry Conti, which was located next to the Fine Arts Theater, which is right down where Tammany Hall used to be, which I don't know what's there anymore on Pleasant Street. There's a guy named Al Lopez, a lot of musicians of my generation, a little later, was one of the Conti family, and he taught guitar. And so in my early teens, I learned to play like East Side, West Side, all around the town, you know, bing, 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 bing. And it was very square. My dad would drive me to the lessons. I was working on it, you know, on a Stella guitar. It probably cost $25. And then, in the 10th grade, I went to Putney School in Vermont. But my parents didn't think the Worcester schools were doing that good, because they were actually slower than the Kansas schools. And when we came here, we both kind of jumped to the head of our class without ever being thought of as abnormally studious.
You do seem more intelligent than most.
Well, my dad was a college professor, so he read to us a whole bunch, you know, and that was huge. And my mother did too, the reading. And I didn't mention singing Christmas carols around the... We sang Christmas carols every year, and that was a huge part of my life. And in later days, we'd go out with friends around Worcester and sing them and go to places. I mentioned Putney School because it changed my life radically. You know, I was always already a little bit of an outsider from being neither Jewish nor Catholic in Worcester. And at the time, the number of Protestants was tiny. They were pretty much locked up at the First Unitarian Church. But they sent me to this school. My sister had been there for 2 years, and I went there when she was a senior and I was in sophomore, 10th grade. And we were both on scholarship because my dad was still an early stage, assistant professor or something. They didn't make any money. But I got there, and it was like a different world completely. In the winter, you'd ski 4 days a week. But it was also very academic and very cultural, a lot of art and music and science. And they only allowed profane music in one little shack called the jazz room where you could play rock and roll. So I already, even there, I would feel like a rebel because they were into other stuff, you know, singing madrigals and everything. I'd be playing my rock and roll records. But, you know, then they had these guys playing acoustic guitar and they could finger pick. They were singing Woody Guthrie songs, you know, kids who were seniors and stuff like that. And it was a totally different world. And my sister had turned me on to Dave Van Ronk. Once she got there, she started listening to this. Dave Van Ronk, his early albums, you know, bluesy. He was a white blues player. My father thought he was black, and once he found out he was white, he didn't like him anymore. He thought it wasn't fair to try to sing that way. But Van Ronk was great, and I loved him. And early Joan Baez, when her voice was very pure. It doesn't hold up that much anymore because she's quite a soprano compared to most singers these days. But at the time, it was you'd turn the lights off in the room and listen to her beautiful voice. And people like that. And I got into the Carter family, too. And the Carter family would play, for a young guitar player, it was really easy to figure out, or relatively, you just play pick, strum, pick, strum. that sort of thing. I learned some guitar off of that and kept playing and playing. I came back to Worcester. Oh, they were also very much into politics. We went down to a 1962 demonstration in Washington, drove down with my English teacher, where the police kind of attacked. It was an anti-nuclear demonstration. So I got into that whole thing. The whole world changed for me, particularly music, but the whole the idea that you're not working toward, that life is bigger than just going to an occupation or something. Life is like art and music and doing what you want to do. Work is good. It taught me how to work a little bit. You had to work in the cow barn, as a matter of fact, shoveling manure when if you were a boy, or feeding the cows if you were a girl for 6 months of your first term. Hmm. And I loved it. Came back to Worcester, it was like descending to purgatory. Mm. You know, the kids were not hip to this stuff. And in fact, my parents took me out, didn't pay for me to go back, which was heartbreaking because my father didn't get a grant that summer, and so they didn't have the money. But really, they thought we were becoming intellectual snobs, you know. And they were right. They were right. You know, the people at this school were, it came from like the guy who built the Levitt towns, his granddaughter, that sort of thing, you know. They all seemed natural. Everyone wore blue jeans, which is something else. You couldn't wear blue jeans back at Classical High. But in the summer, they'd go to Europe on vacation, you know, and things like that. And that was not our life. So I came back and...
And how old were you at this point?
When I went there, I was 15. And when I got back, I was 16. I really became more of a rebel. I would hitchhike places, play my guitar, hang out with some Clark students sometimes. And once my dad got a 57 Chevrolet, this was like in 1963 or 4, then we could drive into Cambridge. And we went in, I believe it was 62, to see Bob Dylan at Jordan Hall, one of his first concerts there. But he was really, to my mind, at his peak before he went electric. People kill me for that, but but I loved him really early on, like the second album in particular. And I'd drive them in because they were college students. They didn't have a car. I had a car, so we'd drive, you know, and we saw this stuff. We'd go see music at Club 47 sometimes when I could afford it. And that was kind of my life, and I learned how to... Everybody was doing this finger picking stuff, and it's complex because your thumb has to work independently of your fingers, and your thumb has to always go and be boom, 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 you know, 1-5, 1-5 mostly. Mm-hmm. But your fingers got to be playing a little melody. It took me 3 years to get it down, and that was essentially how my high school time was played. So instead of that stuff, it's like... So
for the listeners out there, he just picked up the guitar and did that.
So I learned to do that, and that was pretty good, and I got pretty fairly sharp on it, and it was going on. Then the Jim Queskin Jug Band came along, and we would see him in Cambridge once or twice, and it was like the Beatles to me, though the Beatles were also like the Beatles to me at that time, too, because I was still into rock and roll, and when they came along, they changed everything. They dragged it out of the sluggish area at the end of doo-wop when things got kind of popish and everything, and it just exploded, probably a slightly younger generation, though they were older. But, you know, the Beatles, the Bo Brummels, the Animals, all those guys. And the Beach Boys came out of their early Chuck Berry imitation into their psychedelic kind of stuff. I think it's the discovery of drugs at the same time did not hurt the music. It actually made it more interesting. So I was doing that, and then I graduated from Classical. I went to Classical High. I did pretty well there. I did get kicked out. Oh, yeah, I forgot about running away from home.
Oh, yeah, please tell.
This is my junior year. This is 63. It's right before Kennedy got shot. and Jim Queskin of Jim Queskin's Jug Band came out to play a show with Temple Emmanuel solo. Someone hired him there, and there were kids around town who were beginning to get into the folk thing by then, you know, alternative to rock and roll. Didn't mean they didn't like rock and roll, but they were excited about the folk thing. Peter, Paul, and Mary were around. They were a little more the commercial side, but there was a whole bunch of other people who were less commercial. Tom Paxton, Dave Van Ronk, the new Lost City Ramblers were around still then. That was old-timey kind of music in a trio, and I loved them. They were like the Beatles to me, too. And he came out to this show, and I was really into jug band music, and being a young jerk, I brought my kazoo with me, and while he was up on stage playing, I started playing the kazoo along, because he always had a kazoo in the band. He played Comb and Paper really exceptionally well. He calls me up on stage.
Oh, wow.
And has me play kazoo with him, which was great. And then at the break, I said, well, I got some friends who play a washboard and the washed-up bass if you want. I said, oh, yeah, tell them to get their instruments. The second set, they come up and play with them, you know, for part
wow.
of the time. And it excited me so much, and I was so unhappy with my life in Worcester, that the next day I took $10 out of my mother's drawer and took a bus to New York City to become a musician.
Wow.
Yeah. I took my guitar with me. And I went down there. My sister by this time was in college down there at Barnard. She was either at work or at school, so I was hanging out at her apartment outside. Unbeknownst to me, she had called my father once I called her when I was down there, and he drove all the way down from Worcester to New York City and meets me there. Oh. And he wants to have a talk. You know, he was very good at that kind of thing, you know. We had our many disagreements, but he was pretty good at pulling the family together. So he said, well, I don't want to go into your apartment because your roommate's there. Why don't we go to this hotel? We'll get a hotel room for a few minutes and talk things over. Because he's really trying to keep me from throwing away my life, essentially, because I did not have the talent to do what I wanted to do at the time. And I would have thrown myself at the mercy of New York City, you know, washing dishes or what have you. But so he goes into the hotel with me and my sister, who was like 20 and I was 17 or something. And they think he's a pedophile.
Oh, jeez.
I refused to rent a room. You know,
really?
He's all huffy and everything.
Oh, that's weird.
So we had to go out and sit in the car and talk. And he convinced me to come back and finish my... it was either my junior or my senior year, whichever it was. Yeah, it would have been my senior year, excuse me. So I would have been 17. I did finish it. They suspended me for a week for that. They had suspended me actually before that for not saluting the flag, because I was reading Kafka and stuff like that, and I thought any step you take to give in to authoritarianism is you can't do it.
Yeah.
So I just sat down and took.
Oh boy.
They only did it once a week in my homeroom, but finally, my 3 weeks into it, my teacher saw me, and called me out, and I had to go to the principal's office. And they kicked me out for a week, and the ACLU got me reinstated.
Wow.
So I never had to salute the flag. I shouldn't admit that to our flag saluting fans, but What the heck. Then I wore blue jeans once because I was still a rebel, and they kicked me out for that, and the ACLU wouldn't do anything about that. So I had to suffer a suspension for a week, too. And as a final ignominy, Bruce Arnold, who was a guy I knew who went on to become Orpheus, and the first The Villagers, a duo, and then Orpheus, and got, you know, one of the only rock and roll era hits that ever came out of Worcester, was in junior high with me. We went on a double date together once, see a Pat Boone movie, and I actually put my arm around a girl. This is like the eighth grade. That was something. He was playing guitar this time, too, and we were going to do a song together at the senior, senior class concert or something. But when we got there, we had jeans on, and they kicked us out.
Oh, my God.
So I went to Antioch College as a freshman because it was a liberal school. I wanted to go to Goddard, but my father wouldn't allow that. He said it was an emotional hothouse. And I couldn't get into Harvard, and I couldn't get into University of Chicago. I had really good grades, but, you know, I was a little bit rebellious. And also, I never had really learned how to work. You know, I could get by on the fact that when I came back from Putney, for example, we were ahead of everybody in Worcester. So I already knew a lot of this stuff, you know, just from being away 1 year. But and because I read so much. So that helped me. But I got into the college, and I went out there. They have a quarterly program where you work for 3 months on work study, and then you come back and study for 3 months, and then you work. So you get used to working and stuff like that, which I thought was good. Went out there in the summertime, made friends, came back, and got a job. They assigned me to Jordan Marsh in Boston, which was a big department store at the time, and I worked in the Christmas card, personalized card section. But we lived in an apartment in Cambridge, me and a couple of roommates from Antioch, and in Central Square, and that's when we really got to see music. During my senior year at Classical, I had friends at Clark, and I snuck over during Spree Day in the April of 64, and this band was playing outside under tent, and people were lying around on the grass watching it, and it was Taj Mahal, wow. Except he wasn't Taj Mahal, he was Reginald somebody or other, playing in a band that was doing mostly Ray Charles kind of thing, you know, What Did I Say, and stuff like that, early R&B kind of. After the summer, for the fall at Antioch, I came back and worked at Jordan Marsh, and we would go to Club 47. Taj Mahal was there, and he had become like a folk musician, blues folk. Within a year, he went out to California and made his name, made his first album, which was really a great album. I'm going to move up through the country, Paint My Mailbox Blue, lots of really good songs on it. But I took a lesson from him there, and he was frailing, like a banjo, you do a little frailing thing. He was frailing his guitar. He would play Club 47, you know, once or every other week or so. So he tried to teach me that, which didn't stick. But I took a lesson. But I saw all these great people. Jeff Muldaur, who was one of my favorites, was in the Jim Queskin Jug Band. Jim Queskin Jug Band. And it really affected me greatly. You know, saw Van Ronk out there, too. Actually, I was in high school, going back the year before, the night Kennedy was shot. Me and my friends were going to drive in to Club 47 to see Dave Van Ronk. And we got there, and he was standing. We didn't know. We knew Kennedy was shot, but, you know, we was like 16, 17 years old. You don't get the magnitude of an event like that. And I came home from school. My dad was on the couch watching it, and he was with tears in his eyes, and Walter Cronkite was on the air. So we drive in to see Van Ronk anyway, and he's out on the stairs. He says, no, I'm not going to play tonight. You know, it's not appropriate. So we felt kind of like schmucks, but it was right, and it was a good lesson. That was just, I'm sorry, that is interesting. Thing. I learned a bit. Those guys were a little older, you know, the Queskin Jug Band, Dave Van Ronk. They came earlier. They came more in the beatnik era than the hippie era, you know, and they gravitated at first to the older kinds of music and then got into more contemporary folkish stuff. The Queskin always stuck with jug band type music. So we're out there. It was wonderful. I went back to Ohio and in the winter, and I fell in love, and I learned to smoke pot, and I flunked out of school.
Oh, great. All in one
felt
swoop.
Yes. You know, I got into LSD shortly after that. So I come back, you know, I'm 18, late 18. My parents are really upset. Because I wasted their money. It wasn't that expensive at the time, but for them it was very expensive. I come back to Worcester. I think I hitchhiked back. And I get a job at Dapol Plastics, making little plastic ducks and stuff like that. for 3 weeks. And then I couldn't take it, and I quit. Left a note for my parents, and I hitchhiked into Boston to see my girlfriend, who was still in Cambridge, and then I hitched back to Ohio. It took me like 24 hours to get out of Massachusetts. Yeah. Hitchhiking, you know, you'd go out to the Riverside Station right next to 128 and try to hitch onto the Pike. But I got there, and that's when LSD came in and everything, and I was all depressed and working in the dish room at the college. And I got there, and my girlfriend had already cheated on me, the one out there. So I was heartbroken and hanging around there. And then we decide, a bunch of friends, we'll go out to San Francisco once the season ends. So we tried to buy a car. We couldn't buy one. We went to New York City, where a few of them lived. Couldn't get a car there. Came back to Ohio, where you didn't have to have insurance, and bought a Buick for $125, 56 Buick. We got in at 2 o'clock in the morning and drove out toward San Francisco, and we get about 10 miles, and the lights start flashing on and off. Uh-oh. We get off, jiggle wire, they work. We come to the Rocky Mountains. I mean, driving continuous. Well, no, we stopped in Kansas and stayed with a friend of my sister's overnight. Then we'd get to the Rocky Mountains, and we're going up through Rocky Mountain National Park, and suddenly we're down to like 6 miles an hour. This long line of cars behind us, and it gets even lower than that. So three of the guys jump out, and we kind of push on the car, and slowly it goes ahead and disappears up ahead of us slowly with this huge long line, you know, because it's two-lane traffic through the park, and we had to hitch up to the top. We get there, and, you know, I have like $100 in my pocket, which is a lot of money, but that was everything, and I was totally, my parents, you know, I left them behind. I left a note, you know. It must have been very tough on them. So we come downhill, get to a garage, and the guy says, "Oh, your valves are shot. If you're going to San Francisco, you have to keep driving the whole way. Because if you stop,
like, don't shut it off.
If you stop, they'll melt or something. I don't know what." So we drove all the way to San Francisco, and we'd wake up in the middle of the night, and people would be like moving their hips to get the car to go. You know, because it would go fine on the level, but once you went up a long hill, you'd be going 10 miles an hour on the highway. I don't know how we didn't get stopped. Got into San Francisco, and it went up every hill, and we end up staying at a friend's house who had graduated a year before in the Fillmore District, which was a black district then, not far from where the Fillmore Theater later came. And it stopped, and it never started again, and people gradually was stripped. It was in my name, actually.
The Buick.
Yeah, totally. All the tires were gone. And I get things from the motor vehicle from San Francisco, you know, but I pretended I didn't see them. So I was out there for 7-8 months, and I was playing music a little bit by myself and with people, and I got a job playing banjo in the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which was a big thing that was, I was a terrible banjo player, and the guitar player wanted to get me fired. I could tell him, Bill Graham, the guy who became Bill Graham the promoter, was their agent. He was making like $70 a week and driving around on a little motor scooter through. He was a nice guy then. He hadn't become a maniac, and he was nice to me, and he kept me on. One night after a show down south of San Francisco somewhere, we stop in the Oakland area because all the actors in it wanted to see a band, and the band was the Warlock. I had a fake ID. You had to be 21, but I hadn't memorized the spelling of the name, which they asked me to, okay, sign your name. I couldn't do it, so I had to stay outside. That was the Grateful Dead. They were the Grateful Dead the next month.
Oh.
And I didn't see them. I saw them across the room when I was trying to get in. But like a month later, I'd got a job in the post office, which paid okay. And I had some friends. And a month later, they started the Trips Festivals, you know. And the Bill Graham started, because the Mime Troupe was in trouble from doing bawdy Shakespearean plays in the park. They were in legal trouble. They had legal things. He started throwing concerts, benefits with local bands, which were the Great Society, the Grateful Dead. They were like local bands in San Francisco. Wow. This was like early 66. And you could walk right up to the front of the stage. There's Pigpen was there, and Jerry Garcia, and Bob Weir, and Phil Lesh, the whole, and Kreutzmann on drums. And they were great. I loved them. You know, I saw them about three times. And then Bill would let me, like, empty the wastebaskets at the Fillmore. He suddenly found out that promoting local bands was huge. And these bands are great, and he wrote it, and he started doing shows at the Fillmore. Ike and Tina Turner, and Little Richard, and the Grateful Dead, the Jefferson Airplane, which came out of the Great Society. I had had a chance. A friend of mine asked me if I wanted to be in this band that became the Great Society, and I said, well, I don't really play electric yet, you know. I don't think I'm good enough, and I was right. Then there they were, you know, in the Great Society. Had Grace Slick. She was in that, and then she split to join the pre-existing Jefferson Airplane, and then and she took her best songs, White Rabbit and Somebody to Love, with her. They became huge. So there was all breaking at that time. Dan Hicks was even there. I saw him on a bus once, but he was playing in a band, The Charlatans. It was a wonderful scene, but I'm still playing acoustic guitar and starting to worry about getting old and should I go to college in San Francisco. I'm working in the post office and, you know, I was 19.
Yeah, what am I doing with my life then?
Yeah, exactly. So I decided I'd come back to Clark where I could go to school free because my father was there, and I did, and possibly avoid the draft. You couldn't, by the time I got back there, you couldn't avoid it by being a student anymore. But I probably shouldn't say this on the radio. But for example, when I got back, I was so screwed up to have to go back to my parents' house after being out on my own. You know what I mean? Yeah. Suddenly it's like the you that's a child comes back into your body again, and you're having these bad relationships and stuff. You know, it was awful. And I wasn't doing well at Clark at first, so I started going to a psychotherapist, which they actually had in those days before they started just passing out medicine. Mm. And I told him, well, yeah, I had taken, you know, LSD a bunch of times and smoked marijuana a lot. And so he wrote a letter for the draft board, and that was enough to get me off the first year.
Really?
And then I upped it. There was a time, you know, when I had gone back to Antioch to see my girlfriend and found her there with hickeys on her neck. I got pretty depressed, and I tried to slit my wrists, but it hurt too much, so I couldn't actually break the skin. So then, like a day later, I took 19 aspirin, and I didn't even get a stomach ache. And then I took some of her diet pills. I think I took 10 diet pills. These were my three suicide attempts. I didn't have a strong enough death wish, I think. But
thank God.
So I took these 10 diet pills and just stayed up speeding all night long talking to some people, you know. But that was enough to get me out the third time. You know, I think it's more noble than the bone spur guy, you know, because at least I wasn't totally cheating. I mean, and I would have, you know, left the country if they had actually drafted me because I was totally opposed to the war. But I wasn't willing to, you know, to be a conscientious objector, you had to prove a lot of stuff. You often had to go to jail, you know.
Joe Zupan did that. He was in jail for 3 months.
Yeah,
that took a lot. I know.
Yeah, and I didn't, you know, I give myself demerits for that. I should have had more courage. But I just wanted to live my life and be a kid, and I managed to do that. So I'm back in Worcester, and I got a lot of, you know, it was tough at first, but then I kind of got into the Clark scene, and I played a coffee house there one time. There was a I had a good friend who was a folk singing banjo player, and he got me. They had fraternities, you know, and so this fraternity decided to have a coffee house, you know, and I mean, these are very straight people, and but they wanted to have a sort of like beatnik atmosphere or something, right? Mm-hmm. So they hired me to play, and I'd never done a show. I'd gone to the John Henry's Hammer, you know, to play a few songs, you know. I would see Norman there. Mm-hmm. Saw some guy there once who sounded like he was gargling through his nose in the back room. I can't remember who he was, but it horrified me right before he went on. But I saw Norman there. And
Norman being my father.
Yes, Norman Schell, who I would later find out was great, but back then he was just a folk singer. Yeah. at the Why Not, which is what, right across from the YMCA?
I think so,
yeah. Little coffee house, you know, and coffee houses are cool. There was another coffee house down in above the Salvation Army, where that is now. That's Jim Queskin played there too. It's called the Silver Vanity. There was a Golden Vanity, so they called that the Silver Vanity. There was kind of, you know, when Peter, Paul, and Mary hit and the folk thing hit, that was kind of, it spread, you know, things get to Worcester a little late, but it. Mm. And then they leave early. Once I get back to Worcester, I picked up the electric guitar, and I started playing, and I figured it out, you know, how to gradually, you know, very slowly. I took a few lessons here and there, but not much ever. And by my sophomore year, the next year, they had a sophomore-freshman competition in Atwood Hall, which was a great place, and we played the Midnight Hour. And I got up on stage. This is really the first time on a big stage playing the Midnight Hour. And
that's with a band?
Like playing lead guitar, like, yeah.
Playing lead guitar with
lead guitar with a band. We had a singer singing like a soul type thing. And it was great. We brought the house down. And I was electrified. I mean, it was just like, it turned me right around, you know. I mean, completely, this is where I want to be, you know. Yeah. Because partly, I usually want to be loved all the time anyway, you know. So the more people cheering for me, the happier I am. But I also love the music, and I love playing, and I love moving around and, you know, yeah, doing things that you do when you do rock and roll. And so that was great. And then I worked a little more, and I got in a band called the Yellow Brick Road. And they were playing kind of, I wouldn't call it folk rock. It was kind of rock and roll-y stuff. Little Chuck Berry, little other stuff. At first I played bass because they didn't need a guitar player, and then I moved to guitar and got some chops that way. Oh, I was talking about that fraternity house thing. This was early on, you know, when I wasn't playing electric yet, but I had some songs, and one of them that I did, some that I had written, and they had hired me for this coffee house. It's probably half an hour, 45 minutes. And I played, and it was not that good. They were all dressed, the guys had sport jackets and ties on, you know, and I was the beatnik, I guess. And then I, you know, because I always did stuff like this, I guess. I had a song, I don't want to take you to the movies, drive into the rodeo. I don't want to listen to music at a concert or on the radio. If you don't like what I like doing, guess you're out of luck. The only thing I like is screwing. All I want to do is... You can bleep that out. But I played it in front of these guys at the, you know, these. It was awful. I mean,
they should have liked it.
I don't think they did. I think they were annoyed. But I don't recall coming away from it as being uplifted.
So you were writing music. That was when...
I was writing music. That wasn't my first song.
Yeah. Okay.
I had written a song back in the... early at Antioch. No, it was in high school. It's called You Turn Me Off. You know, it was not a nice song. It was, but it was, it had kind of an Animals, House of the Rising Sun chord progression, and You Turn Me Off, and I Can't Stand to Be With You.
Can you give us a little bit of it on the guitar?
You know. I would never, ever play it again except for now. It was like, don't get excited about people people in schools. Don't fall in love, cause you might blow your cool. Talk like a rebel, but don't break the rules. You turn me off. And it goes on like that anyway. But some band at Antioch covered it, which was my claim to fame for quite a while. I wasn't there by that time. I had flunked out, but I did hear that they were doing it. So, but it's not a very nice song, and I wrote about it to an early girlfriend. But I was trying to be rock and rolly and everything. So I had that song and some other songs, and I was riding along through that whole period of time. And then finally, the Prairie Oysters came along. It was just right after I graduated from Clark. These guys, Mark Schultz, Rick Levine, who's around Worcester now, is Duke's older brother. Bill Fisher, who is still playing bass around in many bands these days. This would be like 1970. Got together and started playing acoustic kind of folkish, rockish stuff. And by this time, I'd already got married, you know. My parents moved back to Kansas, and I stayed here, and I was about to be married. And I got married and was working in Boston for Paperback Booksmith, and then for as a social worker, trying to figure out what to do with my life. Because I had never taken, I was an English major, you know, so, and I never, which doesn't get you very far unless you become a teacher, but I purposely didn't take the teaching classes so that, because I didn't want to be a teacher. And then when I applied for a teaching job, I couldn't pass the exam. So I managed to survive that way by backing myself into it. But then the Prairie Oysters come along and they wanted to play. So I got together with them and we played for 4 years. You know, we started off playing in the Clark had a coffee house, which actually I was one of the founders of. And we had a lot of great bands there. This is circling back just a little bit. The time in Worcester before I got in the Prairie Oysters, which was like 71, was a time that Club 47 was really thriving in Boston and that the folk rock scene was starting up too. So we would see, like, you could go into Boston and see in a small room, you know, 100 people maybe, Howling Wolf, Muddy Waters and his band, Paul Butterfield Blues Band, which I had been into already and really loved, and we got them to come to Clark too. One of my friends there was had like $40,000 in the student activities budget, which went a real long way in 1968, 67, 69. So we got the Grateful Dead to come. Wow. They made their first trip east, and they were playing at BU, and he got them to come out to Clark the first time. Wow. They ended up playing there two, at least twice. But the first time they blew out all the electricity in Atwood Hall on the third song, and they had to stop playing. But they were great. You get there, and I mean, it was just amazing. They pulled up in a truck. Pigpen was driving in the truck, and the other guys were in a van or something. And they come in, and you know, they look totally, you know, most of the world hadn't gone totally hippie-ish looking. But Pigpen, he walked into Tom's liquor store down on Main South, because he was drinking even back then. And the guy, a friend of mine, was there, took him down there. Mark Candianis, my friend who I grew up with on Brentwood Road, and he said the guy almost fell. There was a guy on a ladder, and he saw Pigpen, and he almost fell off the ladder. You know, he's a big biker guy. I mean, he was actually kind of a small biker guy, but he was just, you didn't see too much of that back in, you know, in 68 or whenever their first concert was. It might have been as early as 67. But we got to see the greatest bands in the greatest room. So, you know, it's 600-800 people maybe, and you can see all the seats are good, and there's just so many, Janis Joplin, you know, James Brown, Jimi Hendrix, and that totally, it was just wonderful. I got to go backstage and talk to Mike Bloomfield from the Butterfield Blues Band, ask him, well, who are your favorite guitar players? You know, and he said, the Three Kings. Now, I had only heard one of the of BB at that time. I think I might have heard of Albert, because Albert was making a little noise, but Freddie King I hadn't heard of. And I later got heavily into Freddie King, and I like Albert because Albert was more rock and roll-y sounder, the way he bent his notes early on. Freddie became rock and roll, but his best period was well before that, when he was a straight blues guy and he had a piano player. His early records, and his singing was phenomenal, and his playing was not rock and roll blues playing, but it was articulate in the sense of he played phrases that were, I can't make a better word than articulate. It wasn't just playing a lot of riffs. His early playing was just fantastic. I found that out later on in life, and after Bloomfield tipped me off to him. But that was, so this was this gigantic, it was the beginning of the second explosion, you know, after the Beatles explosion and all the British bands and the American copiers 5 years earlier. All of a sudden you had this flowering of bands. And after I was in there and I was working, after I graduated, went into Cambridge, I came out to see the Flying Burrito Brothers and C-Train, who had Richard Green as a fiddle player and also had Peter Rowan as a lead singer. They're both folk rock, essentially, you know. The Burritos were more country rock. And Chris Hillman, who for the Byrds was their bass player and largely a front man at the time. And he was so... I saw him at Atwood Hall, came out in October, I guess, of probably was 69 or 70. And by which time I was a social worker, you know, a young social worker and an idiot. And I see Chris Hillman up there on the stage opening for the C-Train, who actually had a hit. And he's pumping his leg and he's playing and he's singing and he's, I want to be on that side of the lights. Yeah. You know, that's where I want to be. You know, I don't want to be down here anymore. I want to be up there doing that. I decided to quit my job. I had been playing a little with the Prairie Oysters, so I quit my job, and my wife's continued to work as a social worker, and we moved to Worcester. And we played with the Oysters for like 4 years, you know, really tried to make a go of it. But it was that... Actually, C-Train came out after the Burrito Brothers, and they were so incredible that I almost changed my mind. But wow. I had pledged to myself during the first set, okay, that's it. I'm quitting my job. I'm going to become a musician. Richard Green was an amazing fiddle player, and they were playing some great songs. They had one really good album. The second one wasn't that good. And then Peter Rowan went off into bluegrass. But it was devastating. You know, it was just wonderful. And it came after this whole era of all these bands being great, getting to see bands up close instead of in a gigantic stadium. There never were any gigantic stadiums through the 60s. I didn't mention I saw the Rolling Stones in 65, a few weeks after I flunked out of Antioch. When I was back here, they played Worcester Auditorium. I think it was their first American tour. This was around April, I think, of 65. There was Lad's Music was right downtown, and where you could go, they had listening booths. You could listen to a record before you bought it.
Yeah.
And the guy behind the counter, this guy with a tall guy with a pompadour, had scalped the seats to me for the Stones. So instead of like $4 a piece, charged me $8 a piece, second row, right? And this is their first tour, so all their amps are small. You know, they don't have any big PA or anything, but they got Mick Jagger and all the original lineup, Brian Jones and, you know, Keith Richards and everything. And there's a curtain, so they're behind the curtain. They start to play as the curtain opens, and the whole place goes nuts.
Wow.
And it was mostly girls' screams. So, and then you could hear them, there's waves of screams, and then waves of music and waves of scream through the whole show. But they were great, you know. Mick was, their earlier period is my favorite period anyway, right up through around Satisfaction.
Yep.
And a lot of the stuff that my, most of my musical peers I got from playing in Zonkeraz and Crockett, when I was already 10 years older than most of them later on, you know, like mid-70s to early 80s. Those guys got into the Beatles kind of around Here Comes the Sun, you know. I stopped before with Revolver. It was the last album I truly loved, you know, and because John and Paul stopped writing together. You know, they before they wrote together, and they, it was this, you know, like lemon and lime kind of thing. It was a, it worked really well. One would do the bridge, one would do the chorus, and you, Paul's sweet by nature, and John's kind of astringent by nature. And it, when once you pulled that apart, it didn't work as well for me. But all these guys did, and they also tended toward the hard rock sounds of Led Zeppelin. Now, by the time Led Zeppelin came along, I had seen Jimmy Page at the comic strip back early after I came back from Clark. The Yardbirds played, and they were great. The comic strip was in Lincoln Square. It was a kind of a large club run by Paul Tivnan, and it was a great place. I saw Barry and the Remains there. They were great, and he was the same kind of thing where you're up there, this lead singer playing kind of Chuck Berry things and shaking his leg. That was always what I wanted to be. I saw the Yardbirds there, and Jimmy Page was in the band, and Jeff Beck, both of them in the band, at the comic strip. And I told him I was a reporter for the Clark newspaper.
Was that a lie?
Well, yes. So they let me into the basement, you know, and were happy to talk to me. And, you know, I asked, I told Jimmy Page, oh, you guys are great. And he said, oh, you should have seen the guy who played guitar before us, Eric Clapton. I hadn't heard of Eric Clapton, you know. But I guess what I'm trying to explain in this sense is that the two things that kind of differentiate me from the people that are pretty much that I've grown up with in music, because I'm a little bit older, which is one, the early rock and roll period, which was just incredibly influential on me. So I always liked songs with lots of harmony. I like having bass harmony. You don't hear much bass harmony, except sometimes in country music and sometimes in soul music. And the other thing is that hard rock did nothing for me, and Led Zeppelin did nothing for me. And I, by that time, I was into people I thought were more legitimate blues players and weren't just playing all kinds of wild stuff and screaming. You know, because I got heavily into Butterfield, but then I got into Muddy Waters and Howling Wolf and Freddie King. And that's the stuff I like. And Jeff Muldaur became a blues guy himself, and I always loved Jeff Muldaur's stuff. He's sort of a genius that enough people don't know about, because he's extremely diverse, eclectic in what he likes to do. And when you're eclectic, which I am too, it's tougher because you catch some people on one song and some people on another song, but you don't catch them all on the same thing. It makes some sense to just do one style, but some people don't do that. So I was never into the late Beatles, and I was never into the whole English stuff that came after that. And instead, I got into like Fairport Convention, who came to Clark too, and I saw them there, and they were great. And Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks. Part of that came out of the watching Jim Queskin, because there was a lot of this, vamping sort of stuff, you know, in the songs. Both Jim Queskin, but also Dan Hicks, and also Django Reinhardt. Somewhere along the line, Jim Queskin, listening to him, led me to buy a Django Reinhardt double album, and that, I wish I could say that I learned how to play like that, but I didn't learn to play like that. I can never play like Django, but I never even learned all the chords to those songs. But I loved that stuff, and I loved Stefan Grappelli's 1935, you know, the original Quintet of the Hot Club of France. Yeah. Those recordings back there are just just wonderful. And Django is an immense player, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not as interested in hear people trying to play like him as I was in hearing him, because it's not too often you see a, I don't think, I mean, there's probably some combination, a guitar player and violin player, who are that good, but not that original,
right,
as they were at the time,
that,
you know. So those were the directions I went in, and then into the folk rock thing. Once the Buffalo Springfield became sort of Byrds-ish, you know, and Neil Young, you know, all those things, and then Crosby, Stills, and Nash, I was into that to some degree, and eventually got into Merle Haggard and stuff like that. So my pop music stuff just changed from the average flow. I mean, there were a lot of people who went the same direction I did, but I was more into country rock, but also other things. Coming back to the Prairie Oysters, you know, we were just playing old-timey songs. We were playing songs that were humorous country songs, depending on who was doing. And I was starting to write songs. And I wrote extremely prolifically, particularly by, we started around 70 playing with them, and by 72, I was writing a whole bunch of love songs and everything. The Eagles were coming along at that time, and that they affected people. Jackson Browne, mm-hmm. You get that whole range of chords you would use, all the relative minors and harmonies, and I liked all of that. I didn't, but then a girlfriend turned me on to J.J. Cale, probably early 70s. I just loved him, and ever since then he's been one of my favorite of all time. There's just something so funky about what he does. So he was like one of my biggest influences after all this other stuff. And still to this day, I'll put on Pandora and I got my J.J. Cale station and play along with all the songs. I loved that. And at the same time, and this is going later into life, I'm skipping over a little bit, 70s, I got somehow, I can't remember who got me into it, but I started to listen to the Spinners. The early Spinners, around 1972, once Tom Bell was recording them. This was in the time of the Philadelphia Sound, and there were a lot of good groups, the Chi-Lites, the whole bunch of good groups with good songs, young black writers writing songs that were not just rhythm-based things. It wasn't just James Brown kind of stuff. Nothing against James Brown, but was different, a little more romantic, a little wider intellectual spread or something, and musical. Among the Philadelphia producers, Tom Bell was the most orchestral. He sort of came at it almost from a musical theater kind of thing. He would use all different kinds of instruments and stuff like that, and he wasn't always writing the backbeat necessarily. He was bringing it out in different ways. And he got the Spinners, who were five singers, had been floating around. They were in Motown. Motown couldn't do anything with them. And then they finally got this new lead singer, Felipe Wynn. And he started getting them hits with Could It Be I'm Falling in Love, you know, and things like that. And they made, from about 72 on to 77, five or six albums that were good from the very beginning to the very end, but you can't, even the Beatles barely topped that,
right.
You know, where every cut is great,
yeah.
And they have, Felipe would not sing the leads most of the time, but that was Bobby Smith. He had a creamy kind of tenor voice for their biggest hits, which were often used later on as elevator music, kind of, you know, but when you listen to them closely, are really phenomenally orchestrated and soulful, and Bobby Smith singing the lead, but then in the end they'd take the chorus out and Felipe would start rapping over the top of the chorus in an even higher voice and improvising words in the most articulate. It wasn't just like Otis Redding singing la 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 fa 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 fa, which was fine, but it was improvising real words from real life in rhyme on top of the end of the songs and take them out. And going back to the very first record and then up through the next four after that, you know, they had a real big hit with Games People Play. Games People Play. Again, kind of a mainstream kind of song. But if you listen to the rhythm section on it, it's not at all like what was happening at the time. They weren't getting anywhere near to the disco sound. He refused to go there. He just wouldn't do that. And he was still getting hit. And meanwhile, the discos and the bass was twice as loud on all the songs. And all boom, 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 boom. He was doing this syncopated stuff. Tom Bell, I'm talking about. And the Spinners singing was great. The songwriters, all these young songwriters were fantastic. And it lasted until kind of disco crushed everything and rap was coming in. This is something they had to do to survive, you know. It makes a difference when you got to really have to live off your music or die. Yeah. And the cream rises to the top. So, but it did, I have one song on the title tune on the album I made a few years ago, Children So Long, was written right back when I was listening to the Spinners the most. I think it was like 75. It might have, no, actually, it was probably 82. But because we used to play it in Crockett, the band, I didn't write it in Zonkeress. But it has that. I won't give it to you, but you can hear it on the album and see. And at the end, when I went to record the album, which was just a few years ago, you know, well after I wrote the song, almost like 40 years after I wrote the song.
That's well after. Yeah.
I added a rap, not a rap section, but a takeout. Felipe would have done back then, except he would have done much better. And that's on the tail end of the song. And you can see the strong influence right there. That's the only thing I've actually done that's been just like that, because I'm a little, you know, a lot of the time I have a very country voice and a high, thin voice, and it doesn't really fit the genre very well, but it was heavy influence, and I loved them with all my heart.
My granddaddy died last year. Left behind a souvenir of a photograph, a favorite song, a voice so gentle yet so strong. He said, children, so long. Soon I'll be gone. Never give up on humankind. Live by your heart, not just your mind. Children, so long. Soon I'll be gone. Well, people seem so sad today. The world just wants to blow away. So much greed and so much sin. Sometimes we wish it all could end. But long as I can see the light, I teach my children wrong from right. I count my blessings and I pray. Not just you.
be gone. Death, all the things that I really love musically. They're just things that it makes me feel so bad that these people aren't appreciated, you know, and I deeply, it just, I'm sure other musicians must feel this way too, but stuff that Dave Van Ronk did that I would listen to late at night, stuff that Jeff Muldaur's genius, you know, things like that. Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks, who were popular, you know, and they got on Johnny Carson and everything, but they were, at their peak, they were just absolutely phenomenal, you know, and I think that's good. I mean, it's really good to have things that you can just, you know, and they're still there. It's not like a TV show where you watch it and you come back, but it's a body of music that you're just completely in love with. So, and it's been that way pretty much all my life. So I'm pleased with that. Yeah. But the Prairie Oysters, when we started playing, I started driving cab after I quit my job. And drove a cab in Worcester till they fired me for having long hair, which I had under my cap, but no, it wasn't good enough.
Wow.
Yeah, it was funny. Paul Vona's uncle, Paul Vona was the leader of Zocaraz, and his uncle was had a lot to do with the cab company back then, and he got me fired. I think it was Frank, yeah. But we played, you know, we started off playing really folky stuff, and then got into kind of countryish stuff, and then into country rock sounds that were not unlike the Eagles, but you know, not as, I mean, the Eagles were incredibly polished and great at what they did and great songwriters. But we were trying, we tried hard. I wrote a lot of songs.
I'm not a stranger, you know me well. I won't ask for you to say what only time can tell.
Also were influenced by the Dead, so we would do jams in the middle of songs and really try to take it out into space, and it was fun, and it worked in a college environment pretty well. We had a manager we'd gone to Clark with, Andy Levison, and he would get us jobs. This was back in 71, 72, 73, early 74, you know, $500 out of college, which was good money in those days. Yeah. I mean, actually, it's fairly good money these days.
And
so we would do that, and didn't quite live off it. You know, my wife was working, but we got by. We practiced in Rick Levine's house, and his younger brother Duke was about 9 at that time, and he would sit upstairs. I remember one day I came up, and he was playing the guitar. He had picked up the guitar, and he was copying a lick I had. It was my signature lick in one of my songs. I thought that was so cute. Little did I know. But 7 years later, he would be playing in a band with me. So we did that like for 4 years. We fired our banjo player and dobro player because we didn't want to be that country. which was a big mistake, really, because in some ways we were better than trying to be the Eagles or whatever, you know. We played Jackson, Cambridge. We were popular there. We played colleges all over New England, up into Nova Scotia sometimes. And, you know, we made a tape, but it wasn't that great. We had a connection at Atlantic Records. And late in our career, our manager sent our tape to him, and his name was Lou Hahn. He was an engineer there. He did Aretha, among other things.
Wow.
And he wrote back, well, the music is amateurish, the lyrics are amateurish, the playing is amateurish, and they might make it as a local band. Oh, man. So that was a kind of a downer, you know, but right around that time, our drummer, this is early 74, our drummer's going to get married, and his marriage was getting in the way of all the plans, were getting in the way of, it didn't look like we were getting ready to break up. I actually went to the wedding wearing spats, actually, you know, with long, you know what, I think, no, knickers with long socks. Taking LSD. Huh. Went to the wedding, the reception or whatever, and Lou Hahn was there, a guy from Atlantic, and I cornered him in the kitchen, and I said, "We are going to make it." And wow. He said, "Oh, yes, I'm sure you are, yes."
Yes, you and your knickers.
I was such a jerk, I tell you. I didn't mean to be a jerk. I just came out that way. Huh. I stopped the LSD pretty much around that time too. I mean, it's not like we took it when once or twice, but it was always disastrous, you know.
Yeah.
One time we were playing in Warren, and I decided, you know, the other guys didn't do it. I took it, and we were on a two chord jam, G to A minor, back and forth, you know. Mm. And somehow we end up with one half of the band on one chord and one half on the other chord and on opposite sides of the beat, playing in a club, and we just have to kind of stop.
Train wreck. It's a train wreck.
It was a train wreck. It was awful. So I don't do that stuff anymore.
Oh, good.
Those days are long gone. We're talking 1973 or 4. Then the band broke up, you know, because we couldn't get anywhere. We put our whole heart into it. You know, we really thought we were going to make it. We told ourselves we were going to make it. Mm. And we didn't make it. My wife and I moved into Arlington, and I worked at the bookstore again. And I was there. I was unhappy. I tried to get another band, but all I knew was how to play my country rock stuff. I didn't, you know, it didn't fit what these guys were trying to do. And then I tried to get in yet another band, and I was in that band for a little while playing, you know, this over a year and a half, me and a piano player. And then one day they got a drummer, and we were going to do gigs around Boston. But then one day the piano player and the drummer came to the house, and the drummer said, "Well, you realize that Lee's songs are much better than yours, right? And, you know, we want to... We don't want to do your songs as much, you know, we'll do a few of them, but leave. And I said, "Well, no, I don't realize they're better than mine. You know, I don't agree with that." And yeah. Okay, I'm out. But I was really hurt, as you can imagine, you know, and it's probably justifiable, you know. His songs are pretty good. It was really, I wrote a few very good bitter songs at the time about it, but I didn't have anything to do, so I was thinking of going to graduate school or something, you know, in labor, democracy, the democracy of labor, you know, workplace democracy, you know. So it comes into the fall of 75, and you know, I'm almost 29 years old already. I'm working in the bookstore, and who comes in but Lee, the lead singer of the other band, that had kicked me out. Ugh. And, well, they didn't kick me out, I quit, but they humiliated me. And, let me take this back. So the fall of 75, I'm working at the bookstore, and Spider Hansen from Zonkeraz calls up. Now, I had known Zonkeraz because we played we followed them into the Blue Plate. You know, they broke the Blue Plate open. They were great. I was horribly jealous of them when I was in the Prairie Oysters. There were just three of them, and they'd be playing on the hillside at WPI, just the three of them, and all these beautiful young girls, and people would eat them up, and we were the Prairie Oysters, and no, we didn't get that, you know. I mean, we did pretty well where we went, but Zonkeres, they were bringing 200 people as a trio into the Blue Plate, you know, and the floor was shaking.
Wow.
You know, with that before they even got bass. Just piano and rhythm guitar and Joanne Barnard, you know. But I'd known Paul, you know, and I had gone to his house a few times. He liked a few of my songs. We would jam together. So I've been out for the Oysters for a year and a half. Suddenly Spider Hansen, who's their percussion player, calls up and says, "We're playing a gig at Lesley College and Ricky forgot his guitar. Can you have any electric he can borrow?" And I said, "Sure." And he comes and picks me up and takes me home to get my electric, and they borrow the guitar for the gig. So suddenly I'm on their radar. And then 2 weeks later, Ricky's sick, and they're playing a big gig at Sir Morgan's Cove, one of their first gigs there, and they don't want to cancel it. Mm-hmm. So Paul's trying to get a bunch of people to sit in with them, and they want me to sit in. So I say, "Sure." I get my guitar out, and I go, and it goes really well. I fit into what they're doing. My country licks were right. So then a week later, they say, "Well, you want to be our lead guitar player?" Yes, I do. And about a day after that, I'm working behind the counter still. I gave my notice, but I haven't left yet. And Lee comes walking in, the guy from the band that humiliated me.
Yeah.
And I said, "Oh, how's it going?" And he said, I'm behind the counter. He says, "Oh, not good. It's terrible, actually. We were rehearsing in a studio in Brighton, and these guys came in and stole all our equipment at gunpoint and made us load it into the van and stole the van and drove away, and now we don't have any, can't play." I said, "Oh,
that's terrible.
That's too bad." I just got into a band in Worcester that's really big, and so that was, I got to say, I did, you know.
Gunpoint. Wow.
I still can't feel bad about that.
No, yeah. Yeah.
So off I went to join Zonkeres, and that was a real trip, because it was coming into a band that already had a drummer, a percussion player, Spider Hansen also playing percussion, Ricky Porter on mostly rhythm guitar, but he played leads too, Joanne singing, and Paul playing Farfisa, I think it was. And they were playing at the Blue Plate regularly, I think every Saturday night.
Wow.
Drawing great crowds and playing other places, too. It was not easy to fit in that band, you know, on that tiny stage. You know, I want to take a solo, I just squeeze my way out to the front so I could shake my legs and stuff. Mm. But it was great. You know, it was just wonderful. I lived in a room and house on William Street.
And you still married?
My marriage had just been about to fall apart right when it happened. Right when they hired me, we had just had this thing, which wasn't my fault.
Of course.
I mean, all the things before that were my fault, but this one wasn't.
Okay.
And she was getting even with me, you know, for things, and which is understandable. I mean, she was a wonderful woman, and I was an idiot when I was a young rock and roller. You know, I just was. So I said, "Well, I'm going to Worcester," you know.
Yeah.
And I took the little Volkswagen Beetle. I don't know how I got away with that, but she could take public transportation. I now feel a little more guilty and went to Worcester and lived in, and she continued her career, and she got married later. And she's a great woman. I won't name her, but she's we got married in college, and I shouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
And
off you go with Zonkeres.
Off I went with Zonkeres, and it was really neat.